Although this is in very rough form, this is an outline of the topics and the hurdles that you have upcoming for the quarter. So first 2 weeks, we've been in carboxylic acid land. You can see we're scheduled to talk about alkylation and reduction today, and then we'll do some synthesis practice tomorrow. We do have our first quiz on the 24th, on Tuesday. After the quiz, we'll start on alpha chemistry here in lecture. So we have the aldol condensation plus an assortment of other alpha chemistry reactions leading up to our first exam, which is going to be May 4th, Friday. Also the same day as the other two sections. After that, we then get into amines for a while, which is going to be kind of annoying with the textbook we have because there is no real firm chapter on amines. They're just spread out all over the book. And that'll lead us up to quiz two, which is going to be May 15th, at which point we'll start sugars, carbohydrates. So we'll talk about terminology, their structure, reactions they undergo, how to make sugars, how to degrade sugars, which means make smaller sugars or molecules out of them. And that's leading up to the second exam, which is going to be May 25th. Notice also on May 17th, that is when we have our first lab exam. After exam two, we'll finish off the carbohydrates by talking about polysaccharides, sugars made of multiple sugar units. And we'll also get into one of the most fascinating things theory-wise that we'll have done all year long, which is the Fischer stereochemistry proof for the configuration of glucose. After that, we start playing with amino acids, leading into quiz three, June 5th. So Fischer stereochem proof, that is the 8th week of class, and that is when we will be doing all kinds of stereochemistry, justifications using stereochemistry. So as I had warned you at the beginning of the quarter that you need to review your stereochemistry, that's when it's really going to show up. The next week where it says isoelectric, that has to do with amino acids, and that's when we'll be talking about half equivalence points, the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, and all those fun things. So that's your drop-dead deadline to have that topic revisited. After we handle the acid-base characteristics of amino acids, then we'll get into sequencing, which is figuring out which order they're in a protein. We'll talk about making amino acids, making protein chains, and then we'll talk about identifying protein chains or pulling them back apart again. That leads us to test three, which is on June 15th. We then have the last week, which is going to be a potpourri of just interest topics. We'll talk about lipids, which are fat-soluble compounds, terpenes, which are 5 carbon units that are strung together in different ways to make a vast variety of biological molecules. And then we'll spend the day talking about DNA. Our final is Tuesday, the first day of finals, June 26th from 11:30 to 1:30 in this room. Yes?
We don't miss anything from the holidays, do we?
No, we don't. No, we don't have a break at all. The other section, they do. They missed Memorial Day itself, Monday. Yes? Yes, I will. Yes, and I will turn it into the real syllabus, but at least now you've got some firm dates. So let me write those down at least for now. I will, but then I'm going to make a real version of it too. But just to have it all put in one place, let me again say that we have quiz one this Tuesday upcoming. So that's the 24th. Quiz two was on the 15th of May. And quiz three was on the 5th of June. Then test one, exam one, that is end of the 4th week of class, May 4th. Test two, that was 3 weeks later on the 25th. And then test three was another 3 weeks later on June 15th. The lab quizzes, one of them is in the middle of the quarter, so that's May 17th. And the second lab quiz is the last day that we meet for lab, which is June
first. Yes. The next couple of sections, we are going to finish up with, so we've been mostly working in chapter 17 so far, with carboxylic acids and just their general behavior. So chapter 17 also had general commentary on anionic and cationic mechanisms of all carbonyl compounds, but it does also talk specifically about carboxylic acids and close derivatives. Chapter 18 gets into the type of stuff that we're going to be talking more about today. Reductions of various carbonyl compounds and Grignard or alkylation reactions of various carbonyl compounds. So we'll be finishing up chapter 18 today. So 17 and 18 will be the chapters that are on the first quiz. And then the next week's material where we get into alpha chemistry, that is chapter 19. Other questions? Then let's jump into alkylation and reduction. I know we ran out of time to talk about amides the other day, but we get them anyways on Friday because one thing I won't have time to talk about today is nitriles. Nitriles can be turned into amides, which will then automatically talk about amides at that point. So let me check which order we did this in yesterday. What's that? Oh, yes, anything that happens today or Friday would be both included with the quiz, of course. Well, I don't have the notes, but I know what we did. Let's start with reduction first. And let's talk about sodium borohydride versus lithium aluminum hydride, because it matters this quarter again, the fact that there's a difference in the reactivity between the two. So very briefly, why is it that one of these reagents is so much more reactive than the other? Okay, so there's a difference in electronegativity. In the case of the borohydride, it's boron and hydrogen we're looking at. In the aluminum hydride, it's aluminum and hydrogen. Aluminum is less electronegative than boron. Both of them are less electronegative than hydrogen. Since aluminum is less electronegative than boron and less than hydrogen, the difference between aluminum and hydrogen is greater than the difference between boron and hydrogen. And because of that, that means that the hydride and aluminum hydride acts more like hydride, acts more like H-. And so it is the more reactive agent. I won't ask you specifically a question like that because that was a 12B question, but you need to know that there's this difference in reactivity. So let me make a comment upon that. So lithium aluminum hydride is a much more reactive reducing agent due to the greater electronegativity difference between aluminum and hydrogen. Versus boron and hydrogen. Here's where this difference comes up. If we were to take an ester which I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably less reactive than a ketone. Part of the reason I'm going to go out on a limb like that is because if we throw sodium borohydride at it, effectively there's no reaction. Maybe over long periods of time there might be eventually a reaction. But we can imagine why this would be less reactive than a ketone for the same reasons that we said the alpha proton of an ester is less acidic than that of a ketone because of the stabilization of the carbonyl, because you've got resonance with that methoxy group there. And so you make the carbonyl less attractive to H-, it doesn't react. If we had lithium aluminum hydride instead, we're going to see momentarily that leads to a reduction all the way down to an alcohol. But here's the neat trick that can occur. Because of this difference in electronegativity, or because of the difference in the reactivity of these reagents, if we had a difunctional molecule, such as an oxoester, combination ketone ester,
If we used sodium borohydride, it still would not affect the ester portion. It would react with the ketone. So it allows us to do selective reduction.
Of course, if we flop the reagent again, we don't get selectivity.
If we had an oxoketone that reacted with lithium aluminum hydride, and just so we don't have any side arguments about quantities, let me say that we throw an excess of the lithium aluminum hydride in. If we did, both the ketone and the ester would be reduced down to alcohols.
So that's just our starting point, the difference in reactivity of sodium borohydride and lithium aluminum hydride, which was in the chapter before, but we skipped over that idea last quarter. Now, let's look at the mechanism for the reduction of an ester using lithium aluminum hydride. And it's going to be very similar at first to the mechanism for the reduction of a ketone, but there'll be one big diverging point
that we'll see right away, in fact. So, matching what several of the mechanisms in your text look like, I'll write out the structure of the aluminum hydride, which recognize that because aluminum starts with four bonds to it, it starts with a negative charge on it as well. So one of these hydrides will disassociate, and the notation your text uses is to just simply show the bond itself attacking.
A chemist would recognize that hydrogen being the more electronegative element and the one more likely to carry the negative charge is gonna be the thing that ends up connected to the carbonyl, not the aluminum.
So, that will kick the carbonyl open. And this reaction I've written with a forward arrow, and it is appropriate to write it with a forward arrow. Because in the other day when we were talking about aldol condensations, we had a situation where an intermediate versus a reactant had similar basicities.
Their conjugates were similar in pKa. But hydride, hydrogen gas itself has a pKa of something like 33, 34, I believe, whereas an alkoxide is more between 16 and 18 for its parent acid. So hydride's much more basic than the alkoxide is, so this reaction is effectively irreversible. But it's also not over like it would have been if we just had a plain ketone. And we'll see a ketone in a minute being reduced, or an aldehyde, because that's what's going to form right here. Because last quarter, when we did these reductions, we pushed a carbonyl open, there was an alkoxide, and there was no leaving group. But now, because methoxide, in fact, might be a weaker base than this particular alkoxide,
it is possible for the carbonyl to reform and kick that group off.
Which, if you make an aldehyde, that's more reactive than a ketone even. And if we're using the evidence that sodium borohydride can't reduce an ester is the fact that esters are less reactive than ketones, then the conditions which allow us to reduce the ester will automatically cause the aldehyde
to be reduced as well. So we show another hydride being transferred over. Now we'll be stuck at the alkoxide.
Because here's why nothing further happened last quarter. We have either a methyl group that the alkoxide could try to kick back out, or we have a hydrogen, both of which are far more basic than the alkoxide. So no way is any kind of elimination going to occur. So the reaction stops here until we switch conditions and then use H+.
So I've made a big stink about some reaction, I think the aldol condensation, tried to give you a big warning not to mix acids and bases.
However, if you look at the way I wrote this reaction synthetically, I start with the lithium aluminum hydride, and step two, I switch to H+. So it's fine for me to suddenly use H+ at the end of the mechanism, because that's the point where we would switch conditions. Questions about this reduction of an ester?
Pretty straightforward. The main point is it reacts twice.
And in fact, it is the identical mechanism that an acyl halide would follow. Now, yesterday in the lecture, I separated out a discussion of esters from a discussion of acyl halides. Maybe because they are so similar, I'll show them both together. So let me write the note first, though. Reaction of esters and acyl halides with either reducing agents or alkylating agents occur twice.
Because in both cases with both functional groups, you'd first produce either an aldehyde or a ketone, depending if you're doing reduction or alkylation. That carbonyl compound reacts a second time. Unless you use a special set of reagents, there's no way to prevent it. And so you get two reactions. Let me show you the acyl halide mechanism. And then I won't show you the mechanism for acyl halide further because it's identical with the ester.
But just to have shown it once, the acyl halide reacts with aluminum hydride. We make an alkoxide, which will easily collapse because we have chloride that could be kicked out as soon as we form the resulting aldehyde. Another hydride is transferred, which means we get to the alkoxide, which does nothing further until acidification. Oops.
And notice, the acyl halide with the same number of carbons as the ester, they form the exact same product. Now, I don't know if I had put this in the form of a real question or not. I seem to have maybe forgotten the fact that I need to ask this class a question. But I do know I put this thought out there that you should look at a reduction and an alkylation. Did I also point out that you wanted to do those two things with their cyclic versions? I didn't. Okay. So I guess I can't ask the question. Well, I can. You just don't know the answer yet. So, can. What would happen if we tried to reduce a lactone? Would the ring open or not open? Now, first, tell me what a lactone is. It's what? Ring with a double bond. I think you might be thinking of the DHP or the THP protecting group. So actually, a lactone's a cyclic ester. So it's got a carbonyl in it, but it doesn't have a carbon-carbon double bond. So lactone looks like this. Do you think that ring is going to be intact or opened by the time reduction's over with? Okay. Let's see if we can figure that out, though. What's going to be the first step of the reaction? Hydride attacks the carbonyl, right? Okay. Now what? Well, now the carbonyl reforms. Look at the first reaction we did up above. This is going to be an identical mechanism. The only thing that's different is the fact we got a ring. But it doesn't really matter. When the carbonyl reforms, it's going to kick out the other oxygen. Because it kicks out the other oxygen and it's part of the same compound, it does mean the ring opens. Now, when we do the same thing with lactams in a few minutes, they won't open. And I'm warning you, this is a common, not trick question, but a common question I put on the exam, which if you all had any conception that this might be a rough quarter, you did not see the quiz from 2008 that I went back and discovered, because it is the one assessment I've given since I've been at De Anza that I actually felt a little bad about afterwards. Now, the class had been warned and warned and warned and warned and warned that they needed to be ready for this quiz and that it was going to be unusual. But just so you can be shocked at it in the same way I was when I rediscovered, I'll tell you that what happened is they took the quiz, which had a question on the difference in the reactivity of the different carboxylic acid derivatives, on why Fischer esterification is reversible, a little bit about nomenclature, and then some other mechanism thing. So not too bad. Until they got the second page of the quiz, after they finished the first page, which had 13 fill-in-the-blank problems, I think, or something like that. And there were all the reductions and aminolysis and alkalolysis and whatever olysis that I could come up with that quarter, because that's what I'd been warning them about. And they were kind of a class like you, where they were intelligent, but I couldn't always get them to actually keep pace with the studying. So that was my way of sticking it to them that year. Now, the reason for me telling that story is not to try to scare you, because I'm not going to give you the same kind of quiz. But when I'm telling you that I'm showing you the examples that are going to be tough, you know they're going to be on the quiz, right? So, lactones, when reduced, open the rings, that is. So we end up with a carbonyl. This compound has five carbons total, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And there's an alkoxide now at the end, which sticks around because we're not going to have protic solvents if we're using lithium aluminum hydride. But that doesn't prevent the carbonyl from reacting again. So hydride gets transferred, carbonyl opens up. Now we end up with a dialkoxide. Which sticks around until, of course, we protonate. And we end up with a diol. Questions about these reductions that you've seen of a plain ester, an acyl halide, or a cyclic ester, a lactone? What's that? Can that be a protecting group? For what? For amines? Which aspect of it are you asking could it be a protecting group? Glycerol? It's a diol. Oh, well, you could, in theory, use this product to protect a carbonyl, but that would end up with the formation of an 8-membered ring, which is not the most favorable thing. So, or just one alcohol group from the molecule may add into a carbonyl. So you could use it to do protection, but if only one of the two alcohols actually got incorporated, that means you got an extra one floating around that you then have to worry if it's going to react or not. I'll say it a different way. The reason that we use the molecule with two OH groups is because it easily forms a 5-membered ring, which helps encourage the formation of the acetal or ketal, which that's what you want to have happen. Yes? How do you attack here? Benzene. What benzene? There's no double bonds there, just the carbonyl. So imagine that you've got a chair form. It slips under one leg of the chair and attacks on the other side. There might be some steric hindrance to that, but that reaction will certainly happen, because this is not planar. This even wouldn't be a problem with SN2. It'd just be a secondary carbon. Yeah, you're programmed to think bad benzene goes through the ring and all that. But this is not flat. Benzene's flat. That's not. So you don't have the same degree of steric hindrance at all that you would have in benzene. But interesting point. Any other questions? Let's go, since we're on a reduction riff, why don't we go ahead and do amides? No, I'm sorry. Well, lactams are amides, but it would be worthwhile to show what happens with the linear version before the cyclic. But even then, before then, I want to show you reduction of carboxylic acids. Because the mechanism for the reduction of a carboxylic acid is virtually identical to that of an amide. So in the same way that we did esters to show acyl halides and their similarity, let me do the carboxylic acid to show the similarity with an amide. Carboxylic acids require lithium aluminum hydride in the same way that all of the not all of the carboxylic acid derivatives require lithium aluminum hydride, so I should back up. The acyl halide is reactive enough, you can use sodium borohydride. That's a small detail that I'll leave out just for now, because don't want to interrupt this flow going on. So if I have a carboxylic acid and lithium aluminum hydride, what will be the first thing that happens? I heard lots of half answers. Attack the carbonyl. What did you say? What'd you say? Remember, this is a carboxylic acid. Lithium aluminum hydride is an extraordinarily basic compound. So before the carbonyl even has a chance to react, we get an acid-base neutralization first. We then get something that you might not expect. That the oxygen that just got deprotonated, in turn, attacks aluminum. Why? Because aluminum is electron deficient. If it's lost a hydride, it's back to only having 6 electrons in its valence shell. Oxygen's got a negative charge there, easily act as a Lewis base, and it does. Once it does, we have a transfer of hydride possible. Given the way that this mechanism is written in your text, I'm presuming that an intramolecular transfer is not just allowed, but it's what happens. Which now causes a result very different than in the ester reduction. Because this oxygen connected to aluminum, that now becomes a good leaving group. And so we're able to kick it out, which makes an aldehyde. That aldehyde, as we saw with the previous reaction, will of course react.
That makes the alkoxide that, since the second follow-up, or since the follow-up step is acidification,
gets us an alcohol. But here are some of the key aspects of this reaction. First, we start with neutralization. Automatically makes this a different process. Even more so, the fact we have the complexation between oxygen and aluminum, which causes that oxygen to be eliminated. Let's see how this plays out when we do have an amide. Now, one pKa value that I omitted looking up before class, because it's not exactly an alpha proton, at least not the same type we've been discussing. But it turns out if you throw a base at an amide, it is the hydrogen on the nitrogen that's more acidic. So it's going to be lower pKa than even the alpha proton here, which I recall the alpha proton here is about 25. That must mean this is more like 21 or something. But that means when we throw lithium hydride at it, it's going to react with that nitrogenous alpha proton. Excuse me.
Allergic to alpha protons, I guess. So, we deprotonate, which I'm going to do what your text does and combine, after the deprotonation, a delocalization, resonance, in other words. Because resonance isn't actually a step. It's just pushing electrons on paper. So if you combine a resonance step with any kind of reaction, true reaction step, it's always fine to do so. So what do we end up with? Well, we're on our way to something that looks kind of like an imine. But we also have that negative charge on oxygen again, even though we have aluminum hydride in solution. And so we'll again get complexation of that oxygen with the aluminum. As with the carboxylic acid, we're going to get a transfer of a hydride, a second hydride, that will push the carbon-nitrogen double bond open. But that produces a negatively charged nitrogen, which is extraordinarily basic. pKa of the conjugate acid would be, well, since there's no carbonyl, 34, I think. So that's a really basic ion. So just as above, we're going to kick this oxygen group off. Why is it that that oxygen group becomes a leaving group? Well, because aluminum is electron deficient. So if you kick oxygen off of this molecule, it's able to allow its lone pairs to interact more with that electron deficient aluminum. When this occurs, though, what functional group have we made? An imine, which we didn't learn this last quarter because it's 12C material, imines can be reduced just like aldehydes and ketones can. So one more hydride now attacks the imine. Nothing further happens. Until acidification, at which point we're able to get the neutral amine. Now, notice something about this mechanism. I started out with an amide that had an R group on the amide. That R group never got kicked off. If you think about an ester, the way an ester reacted, after the initial attack of a hydride, an alkoxy group did get kicked off. It didn't in this case because nitrogen, if it's negative, is more basic. So given the choice of somewhere in this mechanism, if we tried some completely different mechanism, we could put ourselves in a situation where we have to choose. Does oxygen minus or nitrogen minus get kicked out? And it's so much easier for oxygen minus to get kicked out. So the nitrogen persists. What's the big deal? Well, what would happen if we reduce a lactam?
Now note, this lactam does not have as many carbons as a lactone did. Doesn't matter, it's still a lactam. So the terms lactam, lactone have nothing to do with number of carbons. It has to do with the fact that it's cyclic, period. Let's do the same mechanism of reduction that we did with a linear amide. So the first step is going to be attacking a hydride on the carbonyl.
No, it's not. Duh. First, it's going to be attack of the hydrogen. So let me rewrite this whole darn thing. There. So, we deprotonate the nitrogen. To be efficient with writing the mechanism, I'm also showing delocalization afterwards. We have the negatively charged oxygen, which complexes with the aluminum. We have the transfer of a hydride over. Which makes a negatively charged nitrogen, which now kicks out the oxygen. But notice, since the nitrogen is itself part of the ring, we end up kicking the nitrogen off of the ring, but the ring does not open. That's the big difference between the reduction of a lactone and a lactam. So there's one last hydride that reacts. We end up with an anion that upon acidification we get our product, an amine, a cyclic amine. So let me write down the big note that is the big point of this whole story. The reduction of lactams results in no ring opening. Versus for lactone. A reduction or reduction of lactones does cause ring opening. Lactams, no. Lactones, yes.
Question about these last three reductions that you just saw. Carboxylic acid, regular amide, and cyclic amide.
Yes.
This is a four-carbon ring. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's four. That there's two of them? That's correct. That's why nitrogen's negatively charged. It already had a lone pair, but it was an imine. And then when the double bond opened to the nitrogen, it gave it a second lone pair. It's a minus charge. I just didn't put a circle around it. Other questions? Here we got a little bit of time left. So, Grignard reagents, alkylation. Oh, no. Even before that, let me show you two specialized reagents. Now, every organic textbook of this level I've ever read uses one reagent for esters, uses the other reagent for acyl halides. Every quarter that I teach this, the question's up, comes up. Can you swap them? I have not found, of course, I haven't searched for hours and hours and hours for an answer, but I've searched. And I've not easily found a definitive answer that says, yes, in any general case, you may swap the reagents. I have found examples in more advanced texts of the two reagents about to show you being swapped, but they're examples. So, because this is the way it is taught you in the text, the reagent used for an ester can only be used for an ester. The reagent used for an acyl halide can only be used for an acyl halide. Now let me show you these two reagents. For esters, you use something that the abbreviation is sometimes written in different ways. But one way is to write it like this, dibal with an H afterwards. Stands for diisobutyl aluminum hydride, which looks like this. Isobutyl is a four-carbon compound where you connect through one of the what otherwise would be equivalent methyl groups. Then we have aluminum, another one of the same thing since it's di, and then the hydride itself. You also do this reaction at far subambient temperatures, way below 0 degrees Celsius. This negative 78 is not a totally random number. With the appropriate combination of dry ice and acetone, which are both commonly available in upscale research labs. Put the two of them together, you can make that temperature reproducibly. There's in fact a table of a bunch of different solvents that when you combine them with dry ice, what will be the temperature that results. So part of the reason to cool this down is to prevent overreaction. I'm assuming that it's somewhat steric hindrance that helps here as well, and the fact that each aluminum only has one hydrogen on it. So if you're careful with this reaction, you can stop at the aldehyde. So that's the special reagent for esters. For acyl halides,
it is lithium aluminum trisisopropoxy hydride. Also at the same reduced temperature. So it's isopropyl on an oxygen, so that's isopropoxy. Three of them around aluminum.
which is both providing electron density to aluminum and sterically crowding around that aluminum. This reduces its reactivity, lets us come up with an aldehyde as well. Now that I've shown you those two reagents, let's briefly look at alkylation.
You actually saw alkylation last quarter when you did the Grignard reaction. And so if we took an ester, for example, and used some just random or generic Grignard reagent,
the reaction mechanism is identical to that of reduction,
because similar things happen. Extremely basic reagent attacks the carbonyl. Because the reagent itself was extremely basic, but the alkoxide that forms is just basic, the reaction up to this point is not reversible. It continues because we can kick an alkoxy group off, because it is similar in basicity to the alkoxy just formed. With reduction, since all we were adding was a hydrogen, we would have ended up with an aldehyde.
Since we're doing an alkylation reaction, now we end up with a ketone. But similarly, that ketone is going to react a second time
with a Grignard reagent. So we show another attack. We have a second R group.
In this case, since we didn't start with any kind of methanoate, no kind of formate, no kind of single carbon carboxylic acid, all we have is R groups now. If we did start with methyl formate, methyl methanoate, a one carbon carboxylic acid, we'd have a hydrogen at that joint carbon, which still would not want to be eliminated by the alkoxide. So nothing further happens until acid workup,
and we get an alcohol
formed by double reaction of the Grignard reagent with the carbonyl compound. Questions about this reaction? Yes? Because it would have a conjugate acid with a pKa of 60 versus the alkoxide, which is 16 to 18. So 40-something orders of magnitude, which is a staggeringly huge number. pKa of an alkane is about 60. And if you kick out an R group, that means the R group is the conjugate base of a pKa of 60, which means there's hardly a stronger base out there. And if we had a carboxylic acid, yes, then it would be similar to what happened with reduction, that you'd first remove a hydrogen, and then maybe the carboxylate could get attacked. But since you've asked that, let me write that out. Hello? We're not here.
So first step would be neutralization. We end up with a carboxylate
that could complex with the magnesium. But so what? Magnesium does not turn that oxygen into a leaving group then. Doesn't really help much.
We have a carboxylate that Grignard reagents can be strong enough to attack. But look what we've made. A dialkoxide.
An alkoxide's certainly not going to kick an R group off. And no way is one oxygen going to kick the other oxygen off to form, what would that be? Atomic oxygen. Not going to happen. So at this point, nothing happens.
What if you added acid? Well, if you weren't thinking, you'd say, oh, I protonate the two oxygens and I end up with a diol.
If you were thinking, you'd say hydrate,
which means you get a ketone,
which doesn't react because we already added the acid. So when you deprotonate a carboxylic acid, you could attack it by one more Grignard reagent. Because of what you end up with in that tetrahedral intermediate, you can't use yet one more Grignard reagent. And because nothing happens until you add the acid, once you add the acid, the reaction's over, and you get a ketone. Now, we could talk about reactions with amides, but we're out of time. And I already said that we wouldn't have enough time to finish talking about amides anyway. So we will finish with amides and nitriles tomorrow. Any last questions before we end for today, though? The question was, if I know the pKa's of these different functional groups, will I have the ability to predict where the attack's going to occur? The answer is yes. Why would I make you know those pKa values? So that you know what's going to happen. If you have an acid-base reaction, that often happens first before any additions or eliminations. All right, see you Friday.